From undocumented immigrant to world-renowned brain surgeon. Just ahead, Mayo Clinic's newest hire is famous for more than his skill in the operating room, although that is considerable. We'll speak to him just ahead. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast, too, on iTunes and the WJCT app. Just ahead, the incredible story of Dr. Q as he takes your calls. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Also this hour, as more athletes take a knee before taking the field to play sports, one local veteran speaks out about the so-called controversy over the Kaepernick effect and the music of the Ritz Jazz Discovery Series, all of that ahead. But first this hour, it's the remarkable tale of a poor young man from Mexico who beat long odds to become a renowned brain surgeon. Dr. Alfredo Quiñones Hinojosa first came to this country as an undocumented illegal immigrant. He jumped a border fence on the day before his 19th birthday in 1987. When he came to this country, he spoke no English and didn't have a penny. So he took jobs, picking cotton, painting, welding, all to pay for tuition at San Joaquin Delta Community College in Stockton, California. Quiñones Hinojosa would eventually learn English, become a U.S. citizen, and go on to Harvard. He eventually became head of brain tumor surgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. His story is also getting the Hollywood treatment. Disney and actor Brad Pitt's Plan B production company are developing a movie called Dr. Q, a biopic based on this surgeon's incredible life. It will be based on his 2012 memoir, Becoming Dr. Q. Now, Dr. Q, as he's called, recently traded Johns Hopkins for Mayo Clinic. He just started a new position here in Jacksonville as the William J. and Charles H. Mayo Professor and Chairman of Neurologic Surgery. Dr. Alfredo Quiñones Hinojosa, Dr. Q, joins us now with his thoughts on medicine, the immigration debate, and the American dream. Dr. Q, good morning.
Melissa, what a great pleasure. With that introduction, I think anything that I say next is just going to go downhill.
No, not at all. And what are your questions and comments for Mayo Clinic's Dr. Q? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/First Coast Connect. Email and tweet the show or weigh in on our Facebook page. And I think it's easy to see why Brad Pitt's movie production company is interested in making a movie out of your life. What a story. What a story.
Well, you know, I tell people that I know the movie, it's about me, but the reality is that really is not about me. It's about the American dream. It's about the people who have believed in me, the people, my parents, my wife, my children, my patients, my colleagues, most recently people like Gianrico Ferrugia, Christina Zorn, who believed that I could actually come here to the Mayo Clinic in Florida, an amazing place, to be able to contribute something through my knowledge and my skills as a surgeon and my skills as a scientist. And I think that that's really what this movie is all about the power of never losing hope. And of course, there are some brushes with death here and there and some thrilling moments as far as what I do as a brain surgeon in the operating room. But at the end of the day, I am, as you can imagine, I am humbled by this opportunity to be part of American history.
It is a huge appointment for you and for Mayo Clinic. You are a world-class brain surgeon. You are an accomplished researcher. You were director of the Brain Tumor Stem Cell Lab at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. You have a mission to eradicate brain tumors. Where did that come from? How did that begin with you?
You know, Melissa, I talk about it in my book. When I was a young resident and I was trying to find my way and my identity, not only as a surgeon but as a scientist, I had an amazing experience with a young man. And I saw how this young man, who was the first one in his family to go to college, he was at UC Berkeley. He was the first one in his family to get an education, and he suddenly was attacked by this horrendous disease, which is cancer in the brain. And I saw how this disease tear this family apart and their hopes. And at the time, I didn't know exactly how this was going to play for me, how I was going to be able to contribute scientifically and surgically, but I decided that this was going to be part of who I was. And I wanted to, I identified with that young man because I was obviously an immigrant, the first one in my family to get an education. And I decided that whereas everybody else told me that this was not possible, that this was a disease that was never going to be able to be cured, that why would I waste my talents as a surgeon in studying this disease, and why wouldn't I do something else as a brain surgeon? I felt that this was an opportunity to give people hope. And then eventually and organically, everything began to fall into place until mm-hmm. where I am today.
Wow. And where you are today is so impressive, and what an asset to our community. Certainly, you coming here from Baltimore. Take us back, though, to your teen years. Your story, I think, has fascinated so many people, as you've outlined it in your memoir. You jumped a border fence the day before you turned 19 in the year 1987. What happened on that day?
Well, it's quite interesting. As you know, from that memoir, I was a very energetic young kid who got into a lot of trouble. My mom had a lot of difficulty keeping me in track and doing things. But I had a dream. You know, we grew up very poor in Mexico, and when the whole world was going through a bifurcation of classes and the rich were getting richer, the poor were getting poorer. This was in the late 70s, early 80s. I had a dream that I was going to try to make a little bit of money and just put food on the table of my parents. And by the age of 19, as you said eloquently in your introduction, I decided to come illegally to this country and to work as a migrant farm worker, undocumented. And that's exactly what I did in Fresno. And the first night, they cut me, actually. What do you mean they cut you? Well, I hopped the fence, and I didn't know that the INS was right in front of me, and they immediately cut this young kid.
Oh, they caught you. Sorry.
Now they cut me like in surgery. They
cut. Right.
So they sent me back to Mexico. And I remember the very same night I was, back in Mexico as a young kid. And I had a choice to make whether I was going to be able to follow my dreams or give up. And the situation was tough in my family. We really didn't have a lot, not much. And it was difficult times, not a lot of food on the table. And I decided to try again. And I learned a very important lesson that has stayed with me forever about perseverance, which is the same lessons that I use today as a brain surgeon and as a scientist, to be honest with you.
So the second try, you came across the border illegally, didn't speak a word of English. You got a job as a migrant worker. You learned English. You went to college. You put yourself through college. How did you eventually gain your citizenship and go from there to Harvard?
Well, it was very straightforward. Right around the mid to late 80s, there was a legislation. There was an amnesty, but I didn't qualify through the amnesty. There was a special legislation through the Immigration Reform of California that was specifically designed for migrant farm workers to be able to get a working authorization that if you work hard and you pay some penalties, eventually became a temporary residency, and eventually I qualified for permanent residency. By this time, I was already at UC Berkeley. Then I get into Harvard Medical School, and then I qualify to become a U.S. citizen. That's exactly what happened in 1997 when I was very proud right there in Boston as I was a Harvard Medical student to be a part of this beautiful nation.
That was a big day.
It was, you know, after the birth of my children, it was one of the biggest dates in my life.
And so I must now ask you, in this political season where chants of build a wall are heard at huge rallies for Republican nominee Donald Trump, as you watch that debate play out over our immigration system, what are your thoughts?
Well, this is what I tell people all the time. I spend my whole life trying to find a cure for brain cancer, and I am an expert on migration of cancer cells. I am not an expert on immigration. I have never claimed to. There are people who spend their whole lives trying to figure out this dilemma. But I do understand that the country is going through a difficult time. I do understand that we are going through a process, in a very necessary and democratic process, in which we're trying to understand how will we solve this problem of immigration. And I think that what is going to happen, I have faith on the democratic system as we go through the debates, as we speak and we talk among each other, I think that we will be able to find solutions. Through history, the United States has been proven that this country has been built on immigrants. And somewhere along the lines, if you look through history, we have gone through these up and downs as far as how we feel about immigrants. But at the end of the day, we always figure it out. I don't really have an opinion as to how to solve the problem, but I do know that it has to begin with building bridges, with communication. And as you know, a number of years ago, I started a foundation, 501c3. We go around the world and doing missionary work for free. I bring some of the most amazing brain surgeons and physicians around the world for free. And we try to go around the world building bridges. And I think those bridges are not only intellectual, but also physical in nature, connecting people. And I think that through that process and through democratic process, I'm hoping that we'll be able to find a better solution to this extraordinary problem that we have today.
And if you're just tuning in right now, we're speaking with the renowned Dr. Q, Mayo Clinic's new chair of neurologic surgery. The world-renowned brain surgeon started out in this country as a penniless, undocumented immigrant from Mexico. What are your questions? What are your thoughts about Dr. Q, Mayo Clinic, the immigration debate? Get on the line now, 549-2937, to join us. Tracy is in Mandarin. Hi, Tracy. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning. It's such an honor to talk to the famous neurosurgeon. I was in the same shoes 46 years ago. I am a Jacksonville person. And every time I will send my application to Shands Teaching Hospital as a physician, it will be thrown, foreigner, female, no chance. Then I had thought, you know, I have a background. I rotated to Johns Hopkins while doing GDMC residency. My brother is a Harvard professor. Nothing is wrong with me. My kids used to say, Ma, you speak funny English. So I drove to the department in Gainesville, and I came back with a fellowship thing in my hand and ended up becoming head of Shands Hospital as an allergy immunologist. So my message is, don't undermine yourself. Be persistent, and they will recognize you that you are intelligent. And we are honored to have you in our town. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thanks, Tracy.
Thank you very much, Tracy. I'm honored by your kind words.
Very nice. Lots of calls for Dr. Q. What are your thoughts? What are your comments at 549-2937? Denise on the Northwest side. Hi, Denise. Thanks for calling the show. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I'm excited this morning because I've heard some very positive things about you, Dr. Q. And I would like to know, since relocating to Jacksonville, how are you going to interact in our community with the at-risk youth as you have done in Maryland? And how can we get involved with you?
Thank you very much, my dear Tracy. Well, I tell you one thing. As you know, I did a lot of work in the community in Maryland. You said that yourself. I am extraordinarily excited about being part of this community. One of the challenges that I see every time that we, you know, are part of medicine is how to build bridges with the community. And what I do is very simple. I start with simple programs where I invite some of the children, early age, elementary school, middle school, high school, to come in and see me doing what I do, not necessarily in brain surgery, of course, because that gets a little complex, but to come in and join us at Mayo through programs where I can give them a talk, where I can have a slice of pizza with them, where I can show them a few videos of what I do. And that immediately begins to build bridges between our community of physicians and our community here in Jacksonville. And that's exactly what I'm planning to do. And obviously, this is fully supported by the Mayo Clinic, which they have been extraordinarily active over the years in doing this type of work. And I'm hoping that we'll begin continue to grow that type of collaboration between the community and the physicians.
And how can Denise get in touch with you?
Well, I think that what we have, as you know, we have a Facebook page that Carla Vasquez controls and manages. We also have an email and a special web page called drqmd.com, and it's drqmd.com. And you can actually go there and you can learn about the work that we're doing at Mayo.
Denise, I hope you can get in touch with him that way.
Thank you. I really appreciate the information. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Yeah, thank you, my dear.
Thanks, Denise. We'll go back to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Your full name, of course, is Dr. Quiñones Hinojosa. You know, you were telling me before we started the show that when you were in medical school, people couldn't pronounce your name, so they just started calling you Dr. Q. So that's how that started. At first, you didn't like it, and then you kind of grew to like it?
I tell you, there were a couple of quick things. I remember when I was in medical school, I was sitting there. I was a second-year medical student in this Castle Society school, and the societies at Harvard are like the Harry Potter societies, you know, and it's quite interesting.
Were you in Gryffindor?
I was
or
actually
Hufflepuff it was or Slytherin?
Equivalent to Gryffindor.
Okay.
And it was Castle Society, and here we are, and I'm sitting at the table, and my friends say to me, Alfredo, if you want to be successful in this country, we recommend that you change your name.
Wow.
And it turns out that there was a history. You know, Anthony Quinn, his real name was Antonio Quiñones. When he came to the United States, he changed his name to Anthony Quinn. So my friends recommended to me, you should change your name to Al Quinn.
Al Quinn. That's so boring.
It's amazing. I went home and I remember talking to my wife, Anna, and she says, well, that's not who you are. And I decided at that moment when I became a U.S. citizen that I was going to honor both my mom and my dad through those two last names. But eventually it became easy for people to pronounce Dr. Q and Q, and that's how it sort of stuck, you know. And I look now, leaving Hopkins, where everybody knew me as Dr. Q, coming here to Mayo, it's been a tremendous ability to be able to connect with people. When they can pronounce your name easily, it just is an easy connection that you make right away.
Sure. Now, let me ask you, too, and your answer a minute ago was so diplomatic, and I appreciate that. But there are certainly really contentious feelings on both sides of how to reform our immigration system. And, for example, those that support the candidacy of Donald Trump like the idea of putting up a wall on the southern border, which would have meant that you, with your talents as a brain surgeon, would have never been able to come to this country and contribute and save lives. I think that's why your story has resonated with so many people. People that are in favor of comprehensive immigration reform, which includes a path to citizenship for 11 million people, argue in favor of talents such as the ones you're contributing. So when you hear the nominee on the Republican side call Mexicans rapists and murderers, who are that Mexico is sending their worst to this country, and I really wonder how that affects you as you talk about the things you've tried to do in this country. And then on the other hand, when people do come over illegally and don't make the same level of contribution you have and are sent back, deported, you know, that's regarded in its own way, too. So, you know, I'd really love to hear more of your thoughts about that.
I tell you, as you can imagine, I remember I was in the hospital the day that those comments were made about immigrants, especially coming from Mexico. And I was coming out of the operating room and I was in the surgeon's lounge and I heard the comments and I just literally felt like someone was putting a dagger in my heart and just twisting it. Because I know that there are problems with immigration and I know that there are not so good people who come to this country, but I know that historically there's been always a tremendous amount of wonderful people. But we do have a problem, I gotta tell you. So people know that when I hopped the fence, when I came to the United States, I actually hopped a fence that was about 18 feet tall. Mm-hmm. And I tell people that the problem with only thinking about building a fence is that it doesn't really solve the problem. As long as there's poverty, as long as there's inequality in other parts of the world, people will always gravitate towards wonderful countries like the United States, where people, when they work hard, there's always a hope for a better life. And at the time, no matter how tall the border was between Mexico and the United States, I was determined, and I had the sort of the fortitude and the energy to want to climb that fence. And I think that those obstacles, no matter how tall they are, they were always going to be overcome by people who have that desire. So I don't think that that's the only solution. I think that's one solution that has been proposed. I believe that what we need to figure out is how can we enhance our neighbors? How can we make education better in other parts of the world, especially our neighbors down south in Latin America? How can we increase the economy so that way people don't have the desire or potentially the need to come to the United States, but at the same time, making this country grow as well. And I think that is the challenge. But as you know, medicine is changing. This is why we're doing a lot of these missions. Mayo recognizes that. You know, I recognize Mayo as one of the leaders in the world moving that field forward through philanthropy, through, you know, collaborations, intellectual, academic, medical, throughout the world. And that's exactly what is going on economically as well around the world.
Let's go to Tom on the West Side. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to point out for all those who want to worry about immigration that the real problem with immigration, as far as I can see, exists in Washington, in that, you know, when people are starving or in fear of their life, like they are in so many of these foreign countries, they just do not have the time to wait for the bureaucracy that is so bloated and so slow-moving that it takes forever for them to get permission to legally enter this country, and they have no other choice but to come illegally just to save their own souls.
Thanks for the call, Tom. What do you think?
Well, I think that that resonates with the way I felt at the time. At least I didn't know any better, to be honest with you. That doesn't excuse the fact how I came to the United States, but there are people who are dying of hunger around the world. And I think that we as an amazing nation have to figure out a way to not only make our country continue to be better, but also help a lot of these people around the world.
549-2937, Bill down in Clay County. Hi, Bill. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How you doing?
Okay.
Yeah, I'd like to comment. You know, we talk about immigrants that come to this country and the progress they make, and you know, and don't get me wrong, you mend that because we want that in America. We want to bring talent to the country. But you look at people that do come here that are very successful. Generally, they'll end up working for a big organization, government agency, insurance company, hospitals industry somewhere, healthcare industry, where they have good HR programs, where they have good protections, where management is aware of the issues in terms of minority and immigrant hiring. But the average worker, especially in a state like Florida, goes into an environment where HR isn't that strong. It's a right-to-work environment. So you don't necessarily have those protections. So when immigrants come to this country, if you look at the entry-level positions in corporations, a lot of them are outsourced and things of that nature. So what I'm saying is the protections for a lot of people are great, and we see successes in that area, especially in the professional areas. But when we see people that come into the labor market on a general basis, they have a whole host of problems beside the fact of just getting into the door. And I'll pick my answer up here. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Once you came to this country, it wasn't as though it was an overnight success for you. There were a lot of years of hardship, I take it.
Well, yes. And, you know, people sometimes they know that I am a very upbeat person, that I have in some ways I focus on positive energy all the time. But the reality is that there were some dark moments in my life, some moments of depression, some moments of many moments of doubt in which I questioned myself as to what was going to be my path, not only when I was an undergraduate at UC Berkeley, but even when I was at Harvard Medical School. I didn't know if I was going to be able to make it or not, and as a resident, now as an attendant here, you know, at Mayo, I look, you know, I remember leaving Hopkins and thinking, my gosh, we look up to Mayo as the number one healthcare organization in the world. It's where you get the best care in the world. I would never leave for any other organization other than the Mayo Clinic. And I get here, and as you can imagine, I have a lot of people who have great expectations, you know, not only my leaders, the CEO of our hospital, Dr. Farrugia, but I question myself, am I going to be able to make a significant contribution to healthcare, to science, to connecting back to the community and utilize the Mayo enterprise, the Mayo sort of background and the Mayo principles of patient care comes first to be able to make those connections. And I question myself, but that also keeps me humble. That also keeps me on my feet and trying to improve myself every single day.
Well, when you're walking down the red carpet at the Academy Awards, we'll see if you're still humble. I'm just joking a little. Because in 2012, you wrote a memoir, Becoming Dr. Q, My Journey from Migrant Farm Worker to Brain Surgeon. Brad Pitt and his group of film producers have decided to make a movie of your life. Now, what can you share with us about that whole piece that has gotten a lot of attention as well. Where is that in the development process?
Well, as you know, Brad Pitt has been working very closely with Jeremy Kleiner, Didi Gardner, and then they partner for the first time in history with Disney Productions, with people like Sean Bailey, who's the president of the motion picture, Tendon Agenda, who is an amazingly talented vice president, executive vice president. They came together for the first time in history to make and produce this movie based on my life. They hire Matthew Lopez, who's an extraordinarily accomplished writer, to do the script, and he's been working there in the third version of the script. I think they're planning to finish the script by November or December and start shooting in 2017. I tell you, Melissa, the movie, I know that is based on my life, but the reality, what I think is going to happen is that it's going to be focused on the life of those around me and the sacrifices that many people have made, on the fact that day after day, many patients continue to put their lives on my hands. And I relate to that because at one point, as you know, in April 14, 1989, I had to put my life on the life of someone else's hands, as I was actually at the bottom of a liquefied petroleum gas tanker, a railroad tanker, fighting for my life, and almost dead. I was taken out of this place. So I know what it's like to put that trust. And I think the movie, like I said, is going to be about those sacrifices that other people have made around me.
I think it'll be a riveting story. Do you have any little wish list of who you would like to play you in this movie? Do we know who will get that role? I'm sure it'll be a coveted role.
I know that there are a few very, very prominent people, Academy Award winners and nominee actors who want to play the role. I honestly do not know.
Can you give me the names? Come on. I got to know.
I think they're in the process. I am not authorized to mention any names at this point because they're all trying to bid for the role and things like that. But I promise you that as soon as I know, I will give you a call and send you an email.
Well, and how exciting that must be, but to have that incredible attention. But as you said, day to day, your mission is to eradicate brain tumors. And what a worthwhile mission that is.
It is a privilege. I see it as a gift that I've been given by my patients and their families and their loved ones, as a gift that Mayo has given me to be part of history. And I don't take it for granted. I mean, every single day, these same hands that used to pick tomatoes are now doing some of the most complex brain surgery. And I'm given that platform by my colleagues at Mayo, by my patients. And for that, I am eternally grateful.
Well, we are pleased to meet you and speak with you. Welcome to town. And thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa. I look forward to many more times and many great things to happen here in Florida and Jacksonville.
He is Dr. Alfredo Quinones Hinojosa, the new William J. and Charles H. Mayo Professor and Chairman of Neurologic Surgery at Mayo Clinic. Much more still ahead. Later, the Ritz Jazz Discovery Series. But up next, more on the controversy over NFL player and activist Colin Kaepernick. What one local vets group thinks. That's next.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
The Able Trust and its partners. Committed to providing opportunities for successful employment to Floridians with disabilities, the Able Trust believes that including people with disabilities is part of a diverse and inclusive workforce, helping to empower Florida's economy. AbleTrust.org.
When Larry came home to Alaska from Iraq, he relied on the VA.
VA kind of made this promise that, you know, they're going to take care of me.
And they did, until Congress tried to reform it.
With this new program, if it's working somewhere, I don't know where, but it's definitely not working here. It's probably the worst thing that's happened to veterans' health care in Alaska.
On the next Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Thank you. Imagine a few eggs in a chicken coop when suddenly little legs poke through the shells and the eggs stand up and start dancing around. It's the ballet of the unhatched chicks from pictures and an exhibition by Mussorgsky on the way from a concert by the Houston Symphony on the next Performance Today from APM. Weeknights at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Well, in recent weeks, athlete Colin Kaepernick has been in the news for refusing to stand during the singing of the national anthem before NFL games. His choice to remain seated, or take a knee, as it's called, is to protest police misconduct and violence faced by people of color in this country. Kaepernick has become a lightning rod for discussion, with some supporting his taking a knee and a lot of high school athletes and college athletes around the country following his lead, while others criticize the action, saying it's unpatriotic and disrespectful, particularly to veterans. They don't like the action of the 49ers quarterback. One local group, Veterans for Peace, has a lot to say about this, and we're joined now by Willie Hager. He's the Jacksonville coordinator for the organization. Good to see you. Good morning.
Good morning. Pleased to be here. Thank you.
And in recent days, there's been a lot of discussion about Kaepernick, in particular among police officers and military veterans. They really feel that Kaepernick sitting and athletes kneeling instead of standing before the national anthem disrespects the troops and officers in particular. What are your thoughts about this? Because it's certainly a big point of discussion right now.
Well, I think that the first thing to say is that Veterans for Peace supports every person's right to freedom of speech. To serve in the U.S. Armed Forces, our military veteran members were required to take a pledge to defend the Constitution of the United States. One of the most closely held rights recognized in the Bill of Rights is the free exercise of free speech. Veterans for Peace also recognizes that just as Kaepernick has the right to stand or not to stand for the national anthem, people have the right to criticize it the way he has chosen to express himself. But to question his patriotism and use smear tactics to quiet him is in direct contradiction to the spirit of the right to freedom of expression. His act of protest is a political act to register his discontent with the actions of his government. It is a nonviolent act that demands positive change for a better future for all of us. It's exactly the kind of speech that the First Amendment was designed to protect. And as veterans, we applaud his use of his rights for the cause of equality and justice, rights and ideals that we are told we serve to defend.
And it's 549-2937 to let us know your thoughts on the 49ers, Colin Kaepernick, and the discussion over the national anthem at football games. You defended this country. How? Tell us about your service.
Well, I was in the United States Marine Corps for 10 years back in the old days, and I was a Vietnam veteran. Mm-hmm. I spent two tours in Vietnam. When I came back and recognized that the war was premised on a lie, and I saw how badly we were used as opposed to what we believed we were supposed to be doing, I stepped out of the Marine Corps, ended my career with them, and became a veterans activist, and been an anti-war veteran and a peace veteran ever since.
Lately, it's interesting, as this whole discussion has spread around the country, now the NFL is talking about setting up workshops in barbershops across America between athletes, community activists, maybe local police officers, to have a discussion about this, since there are certainly two opposing points of view. What do you think about how his protest has sparked so much debate? Obviously, that was his goal, is to force this into the national conversation, and in that he has succeeded.
Well, I think what he really did was express how he felt about the situation and folks here in the United States being oppressed in their communities through militarism of the police. And I think that protest stands in contradiction to the Constitution. I believe he took a bold stand. It wasn't an organized stand until the media picked up on it and blew it up. But I will say that the response to it is a direct reflection of the militarization of our society. And I would say that what it does is it premises that others who are for our foreign policies are patriots, and those who are against it or not. And I would say that us veterans are the real patriots because we have served our country and that not all of us agree that this was a wrongful act. Veterans for Peace is a diverse organization with members who have been varying perspectives about what to do during the singing of the Star Spangled Banner. However, all are disappointed in the U.S. government's disregard for the well-being and safety of people here at home and abroad. Police shootings of unarmed people are the deadliest outcome of U.S. domestic policies.
When you hear people say that these actions are disrespecting the flag and disrespecting men and women in uniform, and I'm sure you've had conversations like this with people on the other side of this issue, what do you say to them, especially those who've maybe lost a loved one?
Well, because I believe that it's a false premise to follow this line of thought, that to single someone out for their personal feelings and their stances and then to vilify them. I don't think that's in keeping with our Constitution. And I think that those of us who have served and have seen the truth of war and the truth of the kind of foreign policies that we do have a different kind of perspective. And I feel that the majority of veterans who have had that experience do feel the way that we do. And it's been reflected on social media and everywhere else. When we first talked, it was about like local veterans are speaking out and how what a contradiction that is in our military society, our culture here.
What are your thoughts about the 49ers' Colin Kaepernick as more athletes take a knee before games? 549-2937. LaPlace in Atlantic Beach. Hi, LaPlace. Good morning.
Hello, Melissa. Awesome program.
Thanks.
Thank you for airing it. I just have a comment and also a question. I want to thank the guest for his service. I was a hospital corpsman and during the 80s, so I came after you. And I also served in at Camp Pendleton with the Marines. So, hurrah.
Hurrah, brother.
I think that what it brought, I also sing the national anthem. I've sung the national anthem many times. And I didn't realize how racist it was, especially that third verse. You know, I didn't realize that Francis Scott Key was the slaves that were fighting for their freedom on the side of the British. He actually was talking about them in third verse of the national anthem. I didn't realize that. But I also would like us to really think about the Lift Every Voice and Sing, which was by James Weldon Johnson, I believe. That is an awesome song that really inspires.
Mm-hmm. Jacksonville's own James Weldon Johnson.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. And so I really, and as a result of this attention to the national anthem, I don't believe I'll ever sing it again, although I love my country. You understand? I love my country. I think this is I've been around the world, and I think this is the most, the best country in the world by far. But I don't think I'll ever sing the national anthem, nor do I think I will ever stand for the national anthem because I know now where it came from.
Okay. Thank you for the call. Lots of calls on this. Let's take a few. Susan in Mandarin. Go ahead, Susan.
Yes. I really enjoyed what your guest was saying. It's very inspirational. I kind of teared up. Our Constitution and protecting our rights is just extremely inspirational. I have a related question. I kind of think that a all-volunteer army makes sense, and I heard recently that young men still have to register for the draft, and there was a movement for women to register for the draft also, and I just was wondering if your speaker, what's his feeling about drafting people into the army versus an all-volunteer army? Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it's actually a contradiction for us, too. We feel that everybody should have the opportunity to serve their country if they choose to serve their country. I proudly served as a Marine for 10 years, just as one of the earlier callers was talking about. I love America, but I don't love what's happening to America. And I think that's what the process is bringing about, is these divisions within our communities, as opposed to joining together with visions of peace to find a way that we can all get along. And I don't think anybody should be excluded from the conversation because of their feelings or their actions on that behalf. Because, look at Martin Luther King. Everybody starts out as a protest.
Yeah, sure. And keeping the draft or doing away with the draft, do you think that we should bring back the draft or not?
Well, I think that I don't think it's a threatening draft. I think it's a backdoor kind of draft policy. Nobody has to actually be standing ready or anything of that nature at this point. So they haven't instituted this yet, by the way. But when they do, I think that it's a fair and equitable process, and I stand with that, because not all of us disagree with our country. We disagree with the policies that our country is foisting on us at this particular, the militarization of our society.
Cam on the South Side. Go ahead, Cam.
Hi, Melissa. I was wondering whether or not you think it might be considered sort of an unfair double standard to criticize people who are protesting patriotic symbols and gestures out of criticism of their government, and yet we don't necessarily hold those same standards to people who might not engage in those symbols for religious reasons, idolatry or peaceful religions against war.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. You mean like, for example, Quakers, right?
Right.
There are certain religious groups that take those stance. Yeah, thank you for that. By the way, as we talk about his question, on September 21st, Veterans for Peace and Jacksonville Quaker Friends Meeting will sponsor an event in conjunction with UN International Peace Day. This is coming up at 7:30 p.m. on the 21st, Florida Christian Center, 1115 South Edgewood. What about his question?
And I'm sorry, repeat the question?
That he thinks that perhaps activists are held up to more criticism than religious groups that take the same stance.
Well, I can't say that. I mean, there's no way to really actually evaluate that, but I will say that it's definitely equal. I mean, I'm also a Quaker friend. I'm a member of the Jacksonville Friends Meeting, and we get equally persecuted for speaking out, but it hasn't stopped the Quakers. I mean, they were the earliest of all earlies about racism and slavery and things of that nature, and they're still in the fight today about the foreign policies that I've mentioned.
Tom in Keystone. Hi, Tom. Hi, Tom. Are you there? Okay. I've pressed the wrong button. There you are. Tom in Keystone. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Go ahead.
I'm going to keep it short. I'm old school. I don't think it's right for anybody in uniform to, take the public opportunity to give their own opinion. However, that said, I do think something has to be done regarding the treatment of the racial inequality in America. That's all I wanted to say this morning.
All right. Thank you, Tom. And with all of that said, once again, tell us quickly about your event. It's Thursday.
Well, we're presenting a Visions of Peace program on Wednesday evening.
Tomorrow night.
7. And what it will be, it will be poetry, and it'll be music, and it'll be speakers. And what we're doing is speaking to the unity that it requires in order to bring about world peace. And in other words, we need to break down national conscious barriers and think about ourselves as human beings and how we cooperate and live without killing one another.
That's coming up tomorrow at the Florida Christian Center Auditorium, 1115 South Edgewood, in conjunction with UN's International Peace Day. We can all pray for that. And Willie Hager with Veterans for Peace, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
We'll be right back.
Thank you. On the next Diane Rehm Show, the latest on the investigations into bombs in New York City and New Jersey and the stabbings at a Minnesota mall, suspects, persons of interest, and how these incidents are affecting Muslim American communities.
At 10 o'clock on 89.9 WJZT, your community, your world.
Do you have music you want people to hear? Do you have an artistic vision you want to share? Then join these winners in The Square. The Square is an online venue where artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT-TV and radio. Submit your work now through September 30th. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, the Ritz Theater Jazz Discovery Series is taking up residence this Friday in the Downtown Theater's prestigious lobby space with renowned jazz vocalist Sophia Knezevic on the bill. Founder of the series, John Lumpkin, is here now with a preview, and you really snagged a good one with this singer, I take it. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good to see you. So tell us about the series.
The series in and of itself is made to impact the community here in Jacksonville concerning music, and not only through the performance realm, but also through the education standpoint with us being able to do master classes as well as clinics, and even being able to be here, you know, with you on the WJCT show.
Sure. And tell us about Sophia Knezevic. You know, and first, though, let's take a quick listen to her and listen to how great she is. She once lived for laughter. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, that's going to be a great concert.
Most definitely. She really encompasses soul as well as the history of jazz. Like, I would say she's a perfect combination of Erykah Badu and Billie Holiday, kind of like smashed together.
And again, this is Friday night at 8 at the Ritz Theater in downtown Jacksonville.
Yes.
In a way, this is a resurgence of jazz series at the Ritz. Is that right?
Yes. The Ritz Jazz Jam used to take place back when I was even in high school. And I used to be able to participate there when I was a youngster coming up. And to be honest with you, I don't know what happened to it, but it just stopped. And I picked up with my jazz series in the Ritz Museum. And for this segment, they just wanted to say, okay, you know, instead of having it in the museum, why don't we have it in the lobby? And immediately it was just like, okay, you know, the history is coming back. You know, it's being brought back to the people. The Ritz Jazz Jam is now something that I've actually turned into called the Jazz Discovery Series, which is my own.
And this is your baby. Are you identifying the artist to bring in? So you've got a whole slate.
Yes, we have Sophia coming up this Friday at the Ritz Theater, and then also in December we have Patrick Bartley, who's been a co-host on the Tonight Show with John Batiste.
Wow.
Who was also here for the Jacksonville Jazz Festival, and then in February. We have Christy Dashield, who was a runner-up in the Thelonious Monk competition with jazz vocals. And then after that, we have Andre Murchison, who's a resident of Savannah. And then he also plays with Gregory Porter, who's a real well-known jazz vocalist. And then to close out the series, we have Charles Turner, who's a prolific jazz vocalist heading up New York City.
Wow, so, very nice. What attracts you to this genre of music?
Really the roots in gospel music, to be honest with you. I didn't grow up listening to jazz. I grew up listening to a lot of Take Six, Richard Smallwood, and this, that, and other. But when I got to college, I just decided to take up on jazz because of the rich tradition and the connection that it had with gospel music. So I just decided to go that route, and there was for me, it was kind of a way of carrying on the gospel, if you will.
Sure, and what beautiful music. What a beautiful vocalist. If you're just tuning in, Friday night at the Downtown Ritz Theater, come on out for the Ritz Jazz Discovery Series as they present world-renowned vocalist Sofia Knezevic. I had to pronounce Dr. Q's name, and now I have to pronounce her name right. Man, I'm just so relieved that it's almost 10 o'clock, and I didn't get these wrong. She is Sofia Knezevic, one of the most significant singers in jazz today. Again, this is Friday night at 8 o'clock at the Ritz Theater. A few tickets still available, so people need to go to the box office and get them.
Most definitely, and you can get it on Ticketmaster as well.
John Lumpkin, the founder of the Ritz Jazz Discovery Series, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
And I guess we'll close with a little bit more of this beautiful music. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. And next on Diane Rehn, the latest on the investigations into bombs in New York City and New Jersey and the stabbings at a Minnesota mall. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Enjoy the music.
Once live for laughter, day, spring. Spring, winter is here to stay for a while. To drain of tears for crying, she's too alone to smile, longing for her lover. So this smooth sin will lift like a veil. Someday she'll stray far from the summer world of best. No more a lonely woman. She'll follow the sun.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.